Today on Pilgrim Radio's His People, Seth Trout on the virtues of authentic masculinity.
C.S. Lewis liked the term chivalry, but it's basically the capacity to leverage your strength rightly to protect, but also the deep capacity to be gentle and kind and warm, especially to your wife is the main person in view there in 1 Peter 3, but also that includes to children or your employees at work and things like that, to have a chivalrous disposition.
Seth Trout next. What does it mean to be a man? Seth Trout says our culture is confused on that point. So he set out to give us a biblical vision of manhood in his new book, Authentic Masculinity, Leaving Behind the Counterfeits for God's Design. He's a teaching pastor at Ironwood Church in Phoenix and recently was a speaker on Pilgrim Radio. Here's Spencer Dahlke.
What prompted the writing of this book for you?
Yeah, well, I first got asked to speak about masculinity maybe about 3 years ago. I had just finished a doctorate in gender, which kind of examined some of why Gen Z was so susceptible to the transgender ideology type stuff. And then a local pastor in the area said, hey, we have a bunch of college boys, college men at our church, and a handful of them are getting swept up into this kind of unhealthy, reactionary manosphere, Andrew Tate thing that really praises the desires of the flesh, the pursuit of money and sex, this repudiation of marriage, this resistance to anything that kind of smells like women have dignity is my summary of that. And he said, could you come and do a talk on why that's a problem? And I started to think about what I might say to this, you know, 400 group of college students. And that's where I came up with what ended up being the first part of this book, The Masculinity Pyramid. I do think we've had a thing going on for about the last 50 years in culture, broadly speaking, that was trying to eliminate or reduce or de-emphasize any distinctions between man and woman or male and female or masculine and feminine. You could call it third wave feminism, but the idea was it's the interchangeability of the sexes. And I think lately, especially with the rise of the internet, digital technology, there's been an overreaction to that, to this kind of right-wing red pill. Men should try to be like Genghis Khan. That's what a good masculine man is someone who sows his seed and has kids with a bunch of women. And basically, it's a baptism of the desires of the flesh. And how I think if the progressive world problematically de-emphasizes the distinctions between man and woman and just reduces it to a social construct, the reactionary right-wing unhealthy version of that overemphasizes the distinctions between man and woman. And really, I think trying to rightly locate where the male-female distinction belongs. One of the things I do in the book is I argue that there are more important distinctions when it comes to understanding masculinity. The first one is that man is not God, which is the chapter one, which is all about how a man needs to be humble and how a lot of like the chauvinistic or misogynistic or woman-hating, self-impressed men, that's like the basic thing is they act like they're gods, like they want to do what they want and they're not interested in mitigating the harm that causes other people. And a lot of what you see on social media is just a whole bunch of non-humility because these people have made themselves out to be gods. And so man is not God. That's the foundation of the pyramid. It's kind of like blessed are the poor in spirit. The next layer up is that man's not an animal, and so he shouldn't be ruled by instincts and appetites, but he should be ruled by moral vision, rightly ordered love, this capacity to let greater love supersede lesser desires. And so that's discipline. A man should have discipline, and in that I talk about spiritual disciplines, physical disciplines. Third layer up is that man's not a child. He should not be a blame shifter. He should take responsibility and how, as a man becomes a man, he grows in responsibility. He enlarges his domain of capacity to care for himself and other people. He can be trusted to make good choices. And so before you even get to the male-female distinction, you have to have man's not God, man's not animal, man's not child. And then you get to male-female and it's man's not woman. And so I use the word chivalry to describe that, which is really taken from 1 Peter 3:7, which is talking about how husbands need to live with their wives in an understanding way, showing honor to the woman as the weaker vessel. And that vessel word is really about our bodies and how the strength gap, the stronger versus weaker, creates an additional layer of responsibility for men to be chivalrous. And I like the old medieval term. C.S. Lewis liked the term chivalry, It's basically the capacity to leverage your strength rightly to protect, but also the deep capacity to be gentle and kind and warm, especially to your wife is the main person in view there in 1 Peter 3, but also that includes to children or your employees at work and things like that, to have a chivalrous disposition, which is the opposite of what Adam was in the garden, right? Chivalry would have been violent towards the serpent and gentle to the woman, but he was decidedly passive, abdicating his chivalrous responsibility to keep and protect the garden. And that led to harm for his wife, Eve, and that also led to him being led astray through not having a spine. And so that's where I started doing this. Then I wrote an article about it after that talk I gave. And then a publisher hit me up and said, hey, I think this is a book here. And I was like, awesome. That sounds great. Let's do it. Because I do believe I've been deeply changed and affected and blessed by the writing of other people. And I had been praying for the opportunity to serve others in their discipleship process through writing for a long time. And I do feel like the Lord orchestrated a handful of things that made it possible for the book Authentic Masculinity to be born.
You mentioned the manosphere. Since that seems to be particularly relevant today, you talked a little bit about what that looks like. I'm just kind of curious, since it seems like we live in a culture where men and women are pitted against each other in a lot of real ways, like where has this manosphere culture come from?
Well, I think a big chunk of it is just grifters on the internet trying to make a buck. And so the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. And I think there's guys who just want to make money and they're willing to be unserious. You know, the first stuff I saw from the manosphere, I watched it. My brother sent it to me and he just said it with like, LOL, check this out. And I thought, these guys cannot be serious. Like, they seem like they're acting a caricature out. And I do think that's still somewhat true. Like, there's no integrity in it. It's just a desire to rage bait and cause people to keep watching. It's entertainment. It's like, you know, women may want to watch, you know, Real Housewives of Orange County because they think those people are ridiculous and silly. Nobody actually wants to be that. And then men will watch manosphere stuff because they think it's ridiculous and silly. However, I do think desires are contagious and sin is contagious. You know, bad company corrupts good character, says the Apostle Paul, and what you look at, you tend to become. And so I do think it's, we can't just wholesale dismiss it as unserious because there's a lot of men who are unfathered or underfathered or who are lacking in spiritual guidance, and they are grasping, looking for meaning and purpose and a sense of capacity to explain their suffering or their alienation. And I think some of what the manosphere is saying is not false. Like, you can watch one video from Andrew Tate where he's like, quit smoking weed, have discipline, quit living in your mom's basement, work real hard. And I'm like, I can sign off on all that stuff. That sounds great. And the next sentence is like, marriage is a trap to keep men under the thumb of women. It's domesticating you. It's, I'm like, oh, that took a real shift. And so I think when, especially when talking to young men, like in that 12 to 25 range, church leaders, pastors, healthier older men have to be able to acknowledge that there is some of what's being said that is good. You can't just kind of throw the baby out with the bathwater. That's probably too positive of a reading of it, but you have to be able to acknowledge some of what they're getting at that is true. Is, you know, video games can make you a bum, smoking weed is bad for you, you know, laying around your mom's basement and not trying to take a hill and accomplish anything is bad. I'm like, yes, amen, sure. Yeah, the Proverbs talk a lot about sluggardliness and slothfulness and laziness. And so they're tapping into something that's true, but then it gets distorted and bent out of shape. And I think a lot of it ends up being like recipes for how to manipulate women to getting into bed with you. A lot of it ends up being this self-made man type dogma that is just hype culture that is really going to erode at men's souls. And so if you're unfamiliar with it, you can just look up Andrew Tate on YouTube and prepare to be shocked for how wild some of this stuff is. But it's important not just to dismiss it, but to empathize with the men who are drawn to it and go, what about this do they want? And some of it is, again, the reaction to the elimination of male-female distinction in progressive culture. Some of it is just the desires of the flesh want to be validated. But I think trying to speak into the void and try to offer a positive alternative is what I try to do with Authentic Masculinity and with my podcast, Authentic Masculinity, with the same name, is to try to just provide a positive alternative, not just critique, but to create something for younger guys to get some guidance on that's going to be good for them and help them walk in the ways of the Lord and not against them.
I thought it was really helpful and really interesting the way you approached defining a man and some of these virtues that you describe in the man, the masculinity pyramid, looking at man as a separate category than God, than animals, than boys, and then as women. I think there's a lot of order to that. I'll ask this. You make this claim that as we're looking at some of these differences, there are also a lot of similarities between men and women. You say that men are most like women. We have a culture, obviously, that may want to misinterpret that. Would you clarify what you mean?
Part of it is I was a philosophy major, and so I called these like ontological distinctions or distinctions in being, that the most important distinction is the creator-creature distinction, that I have more in common with this microphone than with God from like a being perspective, because I was made, this microphone was made, God is unmade. Like that is a massive and the most important distinction in understanding humanity correctly. What was interesting, if you go up the ladder there, when God first puts Adam in the garden, he's like, there's not a helper fit for him. And then when Adam is naked and Eve is naked and Adam sees Eve in the garden, the first thing he says is bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh, is he's noticing sameness, which I think is radically different than what most men would notice if they were in a garden with a naked woman, especially if they were yet unmarried, is you think they would notice the difference. But Adam first notices the sameness, image of God, human, like me. This one is finally someone who corresponds to me, who fits to me. And then there are distinctions that are made beyond that. But I think trying to recognize that, like you could, a woman, like my wife read my book and she was like, you know, 80 to 85% of this just immediately applies to women. And even if it's not explicit, you know, if you have an IQ above 80, you can connect those dots. You know, it's not that only men are supposed to be responsible and women have this license to be irresponsible. That's not true at all. But more noticing the way that Adam in particular tends to blame shift in the garden in a way that follows the pattern after his wife. And so I do think the pyramid is structured like it is on purpose. It's about the order of being and the way that men are to function. And I do think a lot of discussions about masculinity get off track because they flip the pyramid on its head and they begin with how is man different than woman, as opposed to that being the fourth layer here. And I think that's where some of like the overreactive, hyper-conservative right wing, I don't even want to call it conservative, but the right wing weirdness gets, is it begins with the claim that men and women are fundamentally different. And I'll go, no, I think they're fundamentally the same and there are meaningful distinctions is a better way of approaching that question.
Do you see examples of people maybe that get the pyramid out of order? What I'm hearing is humility has to come first as creatures before God, then discipline, yes, and then these things, and then chivalry.
Well, I think if you begin by emphasizing the difference between man and woman, you know, men are stronger, women are weaker, and you kind of get the, you know, women are from Mars, men are from Venus type hyper distinction, and you don't come to that question, men are stronger than women, so what? If you don't first begin with humility, discipline, responsibility, you're going to end up having this kind of animalistic or haughty approach to that difference. And that's where I think the manosphere types get it wrong, is they go, men are stronger than women, therefore women should serve men. And it's like, wait a minute, you missed humility. Okay, so men have a, generally speaking, a higher sex drive than women, and men are stronger than women, therefore what? It's like, okay, well, discipline. Yeah, the men are called to have discipline over their desires and their inclinations. And they're not meant to just let loose and let it rip on following their navel everywhere they go. And so if you forget that humility, discipline, responsibility condition the man before he enters into the difference between man and woman, you're going to have a really wonky, de-emphasized or out of balance approach to how men steward the strength difference between them and their wives in particular, but also them and anybody else who has different levels of power in them in organizations or households or neighborhoods as well.
Well, my guest today is Seth Trout. He's teaching pastor at Ironwood Church in Mesa, Arizona, and author of Authentic Masculinity, Leaving Behind the Counterfeits for God's Design. Going back to this idea of, you know, categorizing men and thinking about them in terms of clear categories and differences, genus and species, we might say. I appreciated how we can't really just break down man as rational because women are rational too, as human beings. Categorically, there seems to be a present tense men are, and also like a future tense men should be. to what you're writing about. Can you tell us a little bit about the differences of men and what men are, and maybe how that shapes who they should be?
Yeah, it makes me think about when Paul describes man as the head of woman, or particular husbands as the head of wives. That's never issued as a command that men ought to be heads of their wives, or that men need to act into, or men should insist that they are. It's just an observation, not a command. And so in my chapter on husband, I talk about how headship is not something that's meant to be asserted, but something that's assumed. So the question is not, will I be the head? But the question is, what type of head will I be? So that's like an are, an ought, or an is distinction. Man is the head in Paul's thinking. Therefore, what must he do? Well, he must leverage that headship in the way that Jesus leverages that headship with the church, is that he gives himself for her. He lays his life down for her. He cherishes her. He nourishes her. He's treating her as precious. He's anticipating her needs. He's causing her to flourish by serving her in such a robust and wonderful way. And so the ought flows out of the is. And so when I'm trying to think about husbands being healthy husbands, I'm first going, okay, well, the standard by which my husbanding is measured is Jesus Christ himself, you know, not just being better than all the other deadbeat loser husbands or dads that are around, but I'm going, I'm trying to become like Christ in the way I treat my wife. And so I do think the ought flows from what is. And I think a lot of that's rooted in biology. And so that's, I unpack that a bit in the chivalry chapter as well. You know, men have, you know, 20 to 30X on average more testosterone than women. And if you think about, like, what does testosterone do? It actually tends to make you stronger, more assertive. That's where the idea of like roid rage comes from. You know, you artificially elevate testosterone, you get more aggressive. And aggression is assumed to be a negative word most of the time. But you think, going back to the garden, Adam and Eve in the garden, what if Adam had been rightly aggressive, you know, stood in the gap, pushed back on the serpent, said, no, we're not doing this. You know, it would, the counterfactual on what would have happened if Adam was different is kind of silly, but you go, oh, aggression rightly applied is really good. You know, my wife was a cheerleader and she used to cheer, be aggressive. Like, rightly applied in the right context, aggression is a wonderful gift. And male passivity is a huge problem. And I think the effects of testosterone and increasing strength and aggression were designed by God. That's not a post-fall reality. That's a pre-fall reality, just the basic hormonal distinctions. And so I think observing the biological or natural differences between men and women, and then calling men to steward those rightly under the authority of God with humility, discipline, responsibility, and chivalry is the move, is the key, is what I hope men catch a vision for and are captivated by.
Yeah, it reminds me of Jordan Peterson, I guess. Like, even he, I don't know that he's actually a Christian, but like, he talks about having the monster inside of us that we know how to let loose when there is evil that needs to be conquered and beaten down.
Yeah, it makes me think, this is not really the subject here, but I just watched the movie Mufasa with my kids, which is all about how Mufasa, you know, Simba's dad from The Lion King, became who he was. It was just a really interesting backstory on Scar. This is kind of deep in the Lion King lore here, but it's actually where I end the book, is on how Simba throws off the Hakuna Matata and embraces responsibility and comes to the help of his people, and how every man should view himself like that. You go through this adolescent phase of, you know, no worries, Hakuna Matata, who's not my problem, and you instead embrace the call on your life to serve and love your family and your tribe in a meaningful way. But the whole backstory on Scar, you know, the evil uncle, is that he was passive when his mother was being attacked, and that drove him deep into shame and self-loathing, in such that he became a partner to evil. And that's how Scar becomes Scar. Is he? It's birth and passivity that leads to shame, that leads to making peace with, I guess I'm just not a good person or valuable, and he acts that out the rest of his life. And I do think a lot of male wounding, depression, and impotence, broadly speaking, is downstream from shame and regret around passivity in situations where they wish they would have been more aggressive. And so I think, you know, The Lion King, to me, even going back to the Mufasa story, is a pretty good male parable on how different men carry or don't carry, leverage or don't leverage their strength. Male abuse is certainly a problem, right? The domineering, the authoritarian, the abusive. But the male abdication is also certainly a huge problem. And I'd say, on a percentage basis, a much larger problem. I know much more men who are carrying unfathered or underfathered wounding than are, my father was abusive and mean or tyrannical. and both of those are a tragedy, but most of the people I talk to in my church, their desire is not to break the generational pattern of abuse, but to break the generational pattern of passivity or neglect or abdication, both of which must be broken and are bad. But on a systemic cultural level, I think the male passivity is more an occasion for harm than male abuse on just a percentage basis.
I'm thinking specifically for like young men who maybe have had that sort of home where a father's underfathered or was rather abusive and didn't offer. I think John Eldridge talks about, you know, rites of passage into adulthood, and they never received that. Maybe there's shame associated with that, like we don't measure up. How can they be encouraged to take up that mantle in light of feeling very unprepared to do so?
I mean, at a basic level, that's why I wrote the book, is because I wanted men to have a vision for what could be for them, for their sons, for their grandsons, that they can have a bullseye to shoot at. You know, the book is very aspirational. You know, I don't live out the details of what I wrote in the book. I'm more going, this is who I want to be. This is who I want my son to be. This is what I want for men, broadly speaking, because I think a lot of guys are shooting in the dark at a target they're not sure what it is. And so I think trying to develop a vision, a clear picture of who do I want to be. And that's, I think the book serves in that. The second thing I'll say is you can't replace a bad father with just another father figure. I think most men have to build out a tribe of father figures. And I think that's best done in the life of a local church, where you accumulate to yourself a handful, maybe 4 to 7 mentor type figures who can speak into your life, where your imagination for what you could be is around. Like, I think I have a handful of guys. I had a relatively good dad, but I'm still trying to build out this tribe of father figures in addition to my father. You know, guys who are 5 years ahead of me, 20 years ahead of me, 40 years ahead of me, that can begin to help me get a vision for who I'm trying to be in the next 20, 40, 60 years of my life, and who is succeeding and who's living the life that I would like to live. And I'm certainly not just talking about like financially but I'm talking about like relationally, spiritually, vocationally. Who do I think is embodying really godly manhood in a good way? And I want to get lunch with those guys intermittently to pick their brain. They may not even know that they are, quote, one of my mentors, but I'm trying to get time with healthier, older men, which I think is one of the functions of elders in local churches, pastors in local churches, small group leaders in local churches. And so especially if you know you got dealt a bad hand on father, you're going to need a handful of solid father figures to begin to correct some of that wounding. So positive exposure to healthy older guys is one of the necessary parts of correcting that generational pattern in yourself that you can then give better to your son what was given to you.
Spitballing a little bit here. I don't know that I'm saying anything particularly profound to say that the kind of strength that Jesus Christ demonstrated to the people around him was different than the kind of strength that the manosphere advocates for. I'm curious if you can point to some concrete examples that illustrate for us the strength of Christ full of grace and truth.
Yeah. Yeah. I think about the call of Jesus to be meek in Matthew 5. What is meek? Well, it's the picture that I have in my mind is of a broken and bridled horse, that it's still a powerful being, but it's being led and controlled by something smarter than it. You know, and that's my goal for my life by the power of the Holy Spirit is I don't want to become weak, but I do want to become controlled and led by the Holy Spirit. And so that's an important thing there. And I think about Jesus' command to turn the other cheek, to not give back insults when insulted. Like, that takes an incredible power of presence, to not become a doormat, but at the same time to not revile in return when reviled. Or think about Christ, who opened not his mouth when dealing with false accusations, or Jesus when telling the Pharisees that they're whitewashed tomb, Jesus making a whip and then driving the false dealers out of the temple, Jesus in getting down on his hands and knees and drawing in the dirt when the woman who is caught in adultery is being falsely tried and misunderstood. And so he's able to be gentle and tender, and he's able to be aggressive and near violent when the occasion requires. And so his personality is able to serve the moment and what is required. He's not just reduced to a type. He's not a pushover. He's not consistently violent, but it's like, hey, when I need to make a whip, I can. And hey, when I need to be gentle and get down on my hands and knees and draw in the dirt, I will. When I need to weep at the tomb of Lazarus, I can. When I need to, with anger, yell, Lazarus, come forth, because you're enraged at the curse of sin, you can. And so I think there's a flexibility that comes to the masculinity of Christ, that he's able to be these different things depending on what the moment requires, that doesn't allow him to be reduced to just a type or a certain kind, but he's able to be what Paul says, like all things to all people, and he's able to serve as being controlled by the Spirit depending on whatever the need of the moment that emerges.
I know you spend the last half of your book looking at different relationships that men have with the people around him. Curious if you could, yeah, just touch on that a little bit and how your masculinity pyramid helps define and shape for us what our relationships look like to our siblings, to our wife, to our church family.
Yeah, the second pyramid is the masculine roles, which the foundation is son. And again, the order here is important, that before you're even born, you're a son, you have a family history, you have generational patterns. Some of them are good, some of them are bad, but stewarding those in such a way that helps give better to the next generation. You know, I do want men to strive to become the type of man that a wise man would be proud of. So even if your dad was an idiot, suppose he was wise, what type of man would he be proud of? Well, become that man that a wise man would be proud of. Brother, there's obviously our literal biological siblings, but also 1 Timothy 5 says we're to treat younger women as sisters in all purity. And there's a brotherhood, like a fraternity of friendship that emerges. And so that chapter is looking at how do I relate to women as sisters in purity and relate to men as brothers with friendship in view. And it gives some practical exhortation there. Then there's another role called maker, which is Genesis 2. There's no man to work the ground. And so God put Adam in the garden to work, and that our capacity to thrive in our vocations, to steward and leverage money properly, that's part of one of our masculine roles, how we relate to the earth or our jobs. Then husband, cherish and nourish a wife, how to find a wife, take a wife, encourage and live with a wife in a respectful, chivalrous way. And then father, which is passing on ourselves to the next generation. Again, that's firstly biological. Genesis 5 says Adam had a son named Seth who is in his image and likeness. And so our kids are both God's image and likeness and our own, which is haunting and scary when you think about how I pass on myself to my kids. And some of that I'm happy about, some of that I'm not happy about, the sinful shortcomings or places of following me. But then more than that, I want men to aspire to be elder qualified, participating in the mission of God to make disciples, that they're serving and investing in local churches. Even if most men will never hold the office of overseer or elder, I think that's fine, but that should not give men a license then to like not aspire to be qualified, even if they don't ever aspire to hold the office. And so I love men to seek to become spiritual fathers in the way they carry themselves through their life, and as opposed to simply or merely biological fathers.
You've been listening to His People on Pilgrim Radio. Many thanks to our guest, Seth Trout. He's a teaching pastor at Ironwood Church in Phoenix and author of the new book, Authentic Masculinity, Leaving Behind the Counterfeits for God's Design. On tomorrow's program, it's Sam Eaton on pursuing God's gift of life with reckless delight.
But I think our faith starts to get a little bit same, and I think our mental health even sometimes starts to feel a little monotonous if we're not taking some of those bold risks and those courageous steps that I think God calls us to.
That's tomorrow at the same time right here on His People. Thanks for listening.